Okay, let's start, and sorry, I'm a couple of minutes late, and I was at the wrong place for this lecture. Today, we will have the last lecture about quantitative research. Please be quiet unless you are going to ask a question. So this far, we have discussed research design a bit. So we have four main research designs for quantitative research. We have the experiment, where we manipulate something. In treatment group, we have the control group that we don't manipulate, and then we measure the outcome. And if there's a difference in the outcome, that's a causal effect of the treatment or the manipulation. Then we had a survey where we asked people questions, and then people give our data. Give us data, and then we had field study, which differs from a survey that instead of asking people questions, asking people to provide us data, we go and we observe people, what people do, and we store that as numerical data. And then we had archival or secondary data analysis, which refers to using data sets that other people have collected for other purposes for our own research. For example, we could be using the attendance of people here, and then we would be using the grades, which are data collected for some other purposes, and try to calculate the correlation and then make a claim about it. Then we went through the three conditions for causality, and that was the most important things on the first lecture. Then on the second lecture, we discussed measurement. How do we quantify things that are not really observable directly? Like how do we quantify a person's height or weight? That's fairly straightforward physical measurement. Okay, so how do we quantify people's attitudes towards computers and things like that? The most common way of measurement in information systems research is to use a survey. So we asked people questions, and then that we use those questions as measure of the concepts that we want to study. So we, for example, in the Venkatesh paper, they ask about questions about the people's internet self-efficacy and people's intention to use e-government, and then they correlate those questions and try to make a causal claim that the higher your internet self-efficacy, the more likely you are going to be using government information systems. Then last week, we discussed a bit about regression analysis, which is the main tool for ruling out alternative explanations in information systems research. So whereas correlation tells you what is the relationships between two variables, for example, person's attendance or activity on lectures and exam score, regression analysis allows you to take more than one explanatory variable into consideration. So regression analysis answers the question of if we have these, let's say, five variables that we think that influence one dependent variable, then which one of the five variables really matters more? So regression analysis allows us to rule out alternative explanations for the data, and that's the main purpose for using that analysis in information systems research. Today is the last lecture, and we will be putting this all together. So this is a good lecture for asking questions, and how I'm going to structure the lecture is that I'll first say a few words about how you write a paper or how you write a master's thesis using quantitative techniques. So what kind of things you have to put in your report if you want to use these research designs and techniques. Then we'll look at an actual data analysis or research project that I did. We'll start with a hypothesis, and then I'll go through how I went about testing that hypothesis, demonstrating you the actual analysis. Then in the end, we'll take a look at general issues like when and why you should do a quantitative study versus a qualitative study. So let's go on. The first question is, what do you do when you write your study? So we read the Venkatesh paper, and they wrote it. So what do you need to do when you do your own study using quantitative techniques? The quantitative analysis articles or reports or master theses that follow that use quantitative techniques typically follow this kind of structure. So we have first an introduction that tells what is the study about? And then we have literature review, that's in the master's thesis as well, which tells what do we know about this phenomenon or this subject of study from prior studies and theories. And usually in the literature review, we try to explain why something happens. So the important part in the theory part or the literature review part is to answer why something happens, because that's the core of a theory. The part in literature review typically also presents some testable hypothesis. So if we review literature on, let's say, how people's internet self-efficacy influence their intentions to use information systems, then we can probably end with a testable hypothesis that internet efficacy, when we consider other things, is still positively associated with intentions use, that kind of thing. So the hypotheses are in that section as well. And then the next part, the data and methods, explains how we tested those hypotheses. And I'm going to go through more about that on the next slide. And then after we present our data and methods, which constitute the research design, then it follows, the results section follows. The results section, there we show the actual numbers. So this is what the numbers that our research gave us actually tell us. Then we have discussion where we tell the reader what do the numbers mean. So results is more like this is what the numbers are, and then discussion is more like this is what the numbers mean in broader context. And in conclusions, we usually say a paragraph or two about future research and what's the big picture of the study. My former colleague coined this master's thesis wave to describe this structure. The idea is that in the introduction, you have a really high level of abstraction. You talk in general terms. And then when you go to the data and methods, then you are very specific. You are discussing specifically what you did in that study. And then in the results section, you're still quite specific. So you just talk about the numbers, what numbers you have. And then you again increase the level of abstraction and tell in the discussion section what the numbers mean. So it goes from specific to from general to specific and then back. Then the data and methods part in quantitative article or master thesis nearly always also follow a certain structure. Understanding the structure is important, because if you want to do this kind of study yourself, then at least for me it's important, useful to first write like a skeleton of the paper that I'm going to do to see what kind of things I need there, and then I just do the things that I need for the paper or the thesis, and then I write the thesis at the end. So we start with samples. So what are the things that we study? If we study organizations, which organizations? How do we take a sample? So, or do we study the full population? If our full population, for example, we're interested in university students, and we could say that the students of this university is our population. So do we measure every student who attends to the university, or do we take a sample? That kind of decisions go to the sample and data part. And the important part about the sample and data is that should give the reader an idea of what conditions are or how generalizable your results could be. So if we study, for example, the use of information systems in bakeries in Eastern Finland, then that limits our generalizability. We probably shouldn't be generalizing to multinational corporations or American stock-listed companies from that kind of companies. We could be generalizing from those small bakeries to other small companies in Finland, for example. Then we have measures. So the measures tell what are the data. So which numbers do we have? So if you think your data as an Excel sheet, then the sample tells what are the rows on my Excel sheet. Then the measures part tells what are the columns on my Excel sheet. In that part, we explain how we assess reliability and how we assess validity of our measures. The most common way of doing measurement is that we look at, if we want to measure something, we go back and we look how others have measured it before, and then we pick one of those techniques applied by others. Because developing your own survey questions or your own other kinds of measures, That can be challenging. So we usually try to be a bit more economical in terms of how much work we put into the study and use measures developed by somebody else. Also, that helps that it makes our research more compatible with existing research. So if we are, if everyone is measuring height in centimeters, it's better for us to stick to centimeters than to measure height in inches, because it makes these results more comparable. Then the C is data collection. If we do a survey, then we explain how we did the survey. So A sample tells who we sent our survey to, B tells what are the survey questions, and then C tells, okay, so how did we do it in practice? Or if we collected data in the field, how did we do it in practice? If you are just using data from some database, like you are using grades for the course from the information system, and then we are using participation on or your activity on the course website from Moodle, then the data collection is just two sentences. Then it's not needed. It could be included in the measures part. Then the analysis part. If you are doing something beyond basic regression analysis, it's a good idea to explain your reader which analysis techniques you applied and why, and what other alternatives you considered, and what made you choose the techniques that you actually chose. If the analysis, again, is not very complicated, that part can be left out. But you will always have at least sample and measures. Quite often, you will have data collection and analysis. In a master's thesis, where you have lots of pages to write on, the master's thesis, there's no limitation in contrast to journal articles, then typically you have all four of these sections in your data and methods part. Importantly, the data and methods part describe that part of the research design. So we can see a clear mapping here. So we have sample, describes sampling, then we have measures, describes measurement, data collection, describes data collection, and then data analysis and interpretation describes data analysis and or how did you analyze the data. So we have this description of these key elements of research design. Then you have a preparation of research design, which typically you don't, it basically covers all these aspects, so it's not addressed explicitly. And data processing, like how did you process your data? When we have survey data, we have data from some other sources. Let's say we do two surveys, we often have to merge data sets. We have to clean the data because some people don't answer our survey seriously. We have to eliminate those answers. Some people only give partial answers. We need to do something about that. So that's more like routine work that you have to do before you analyze the data. And typically it's not reported because it's so clear that you have to do some things, and also it doesn't really influence the reliability and validity of our study. So that's not typically reported in media. The Venkates paper that I gave you as an example follows this same structure. So we have introduction, they have theoretical foundation and model development that map to literature review. So they first explain the background literature, and then they explain their own theory and their hypothesis. But you can split the literature review into multiple sections if you want. Then they have method, and which has research context, sample and procedures and measures. So their context was somewhat important to them. So they explain that in a separate section. Then we have sample and procedures with the same as sample here. Because the data collection is pretty basic, then their data collection is included there, and the data analysis is very basic, factor analysis, regression analysis, those are the basic tools, no need to explain it in detail. Then they have the results section where they just give the numbers, and discussion section where they explain what the numbers mean, and typically you have also the limitations discussed in the discussion section, and then they had conclusions like this structure. So you can see that the structure really is something that people apply. And this is how I recommend this kind of structure for your master's thesis. Okay, so when you do your own master's thesis, using quantitative techniques or anything else, you need to have a structure and then you need to put content into that structure. To do a quantitative study, you need to collect data and you need to analyze the data. And to analyze the data, then you need to have some kind of computer software that you apply for the data analysis. So I'll say a few words about statistical software. Excel can be used for statistical analysis, but trying to do so quickly reveals that it's a really bad idea to try to do this kind of work with Excel, because it's very limited, it gets into your way. It's a much better idea to use an actual statistical software if you want to do statistical analysis. I have experience on and we use three general statistical packages. We have our SPSS, and we have Stata, and then we have R. And these are quite different software packages. If you just are doing a one-shot study for your master's thesis, then SPSS is probably a good idea for you, because it's fairly easy to do basic things with SPSS. And SPSS is installed on all computers, and you can buy it yourself with 30 euros. You may be able to install it with a campus license on your own computer. I'm not sure what the license is now. So that's a good tool for beginners. But if you want to do more serious research, then SPSS is not the right tool for it. It's kind of like if you want to start riding a bike, then starting with a tricycle is a good idea. But if you want to be a world-class cyclist, then you can't do it with tricycle. You need a proper bike. So Stata is the proper bike here. So that's a statistical package that's aimed for professionals. It's installed in the computer lab. It's not that much more difficult to use than SPSS. They are fairly similar, but for historical reasons, we've had SPSS longer. People tend to favor SPSS. Then we have R, which is an open source statistical programming environment. And that's, if you're technically oriented, then that may be a good tool for you. I've guided some master theses that apply R. The only master thesis that I've ever given a 5 used R for data analysis. So it's doable. It has a learning curve, but once you learn it, it's much more powerful than these two alternatives. So these are the tools that you can apply, and how you apply these tools, it's quite different from applying Excel. So in Excel, you have the data in one sheet, and then you define different calculations in different cells in the same sheet, or then you have two sheets in the same file, and you define the calculations in the sheet. So in Excel, you have this, it's not clear which order the calculations are done, and the data and the calculations are in the same file. So it's not easy to separate the data and the calculation from one another. Statistical software work a bit differently. So the idea of this software is that you have data file, which is a separate file. Then you have an analysis file which specifies what kind of analysis you apply to the data file, and that's a separate file. And then typically you have one or more results files. What's the advantage here is that the analysis file documents a clear workflow how your analysis works, and then you can also write comments there. You can use this software in three different ways. They have graphical user interfaces where you can just point and click your way through and do a regression analysis or a factor analysis. In SPSS, that's the most common way of using. Then you can also type commands. Stata and R allow you to type. Once you know how you type commands, then it's a lot faster to type than to do point and click. And finally, you can do your analysis as a command file, which tells me that, okay, this is my analysis plan, and this is how it's implemented. Whenever you have the data file and the analysis file, you can always completely replicate the results. So there is no need to point and click again. And this is important if, for example, in your master's thesis, you submit it for initial evaluation, and then your supervisor finds out that there's a problem. For example, you had some cases in the data that shouldn't be there, so the supervisor tells you to eliminate those cases and redo all the analysis. If you point and click, then it's a lot of point and clicking. If you did your analysis using an analysis file, then you just eliminate those observations that you don't need in your data and you rerun the analysis file. In practice, most people who who are professional researchers do this with analysis or command files. I may experiment with different analysis using the menus or typing commands, but whenever I'm working on a project, it always goes to a command file. This is what the software looks like. So you can see here, this is SPSS. There's a clear, the menus are prominently displayed up here. So that's where you do analysis. And then you have your data visible here. So it looks like Excel file. SPSS is kind of user-friendly because it gives you the data file. So it's more familiar than the other software that don't show you your data. And then when you do your analysis, you'll get output. For example, this is regression analysis, then there are some tables that the regression analysis produces for you. So in contrast to Excel, where the data and analysis and results live in the single file, in SPSS, you have the data file and the results file in separately. So they live in separate windows, it's a separate file. And then if you have a command file, then that's a third window. Stata looks somewhat different. So this looks very different from Excel. So you can see in SPSS, you have the data here in the behind in the window. It looks similar to Excel. So this is Stata's main window. And Stata doesn't show you the data by default. You can, of course, browse the data, but it's not shown by default because usually just looking at your numbers, the raw numbers, it's not the most effective way of efficient way of analyzing data. It's a lot better to look at the data through means and standard deviations and other statistics rather than looking at the actual raw numbers. So we have here, you can type commands, you have menus where up here where you can do commands from here, and then output comes here. So the output in SPSS, it's rich text formatted here, it's raw text, whichever you like, it's a personal preference. Then we have RStudio, which is looks the same, so you got some input here. So these are analysis files. So RStudio doesn't have any menus. That creates it, makes it a bit difficult to learn. And then you have output that comes here as text, and then you have all kinds of information about what you're doing on the right-hand side. So which one should you use? I use Stata and R for my research. Perhaps nowadays a bit more R than Stata. And I think R is more flexible, but Stata is more geared toward getting results quickly. So if some analysis is implemented in Stata, then I may go for that because that allows me to get it done more quickly than R that requires more, let's say, programming. Then the people who I know use mainly SPSS and Stata. There is now increasing, the use of R is increasing, particularly our PhD students apply R. So it's kind of like the thing that you start your career with. That's what you carry with you. Students here use mainly SPSS and R because we don't have a strong tradition of using Stata. Most master students tend to use SPSS because it's quick to learn and it gets the job done in most of the cases. If it's more complicated analysis, then R can be preferable. So that's quickly, briefly about the kind of software that we have here. So that's my brief intro of how you do your own research. And my next thing that I'm going to talk about for about 45 minutes, I'll demonstrate you the workflow for an actual data analysis project using actual data. Any questions this part about how you go about writing a quantitative report? Okay, let's go to the real-world data analysis. And the workflow for a quantitative paper is as shown here. And importantly, the quality of the study is typically defined before we collect any data. So the decisions that you make, which things that you measure, what are the things that are being measured, so which are the rows and columns in your Excel sheet, typically determine how high the quality of the study is. If you have bad data, then there's really not much that you can do about it. So a fancy analysis cannot fix a data problem. But if you have good data and a bad analysis, then the analysis is always something that can be fixed. let's take a look at this part here. So how do we go about when we have a research question, we have a hypothesis to test, so how do we go about testing it? And to do that, we need a hypothesis. So I will take a hypothesis from an article that discussed the relationship between company growth motivation and company growth. We studied this in the context of small software companies. So we did a software business study, and we took our research question from this entrepreneurship journal. So our hypothesis is that growth motivation at time one is has a positive effect on growth at time two. So my first question is, why is growth motivation measured at time one and then growth at time two? So what's the reason? It would be simpler to measure everything at the same point. So why is there a time delay between measuring growth motivation of a company and then growth of the company? This relates to the second condition out of the three conditions for causality. You can infer the direction of the effect, because if you measure the cause before the effect, then you can infer that it's more likely that the cause influences the effect. The effect cannot influence the cause, because that would be going back in time. So that's a very common strategy for doing the direction of influence out of the three conditions. So the first was association, then direction of influence, and then elimination of rival explanations for the associates. So how do we test this? So how do we test this kind of hypothesis? We need to sample something, and we need to measure something. So if we are studying small software companies in Finland, we sample those. What do we measure? Yeah, we measure growth over time. We measure growth motivation somehow. What else? Is it enough that we measure growth and growth motivation of companies? Do we need to do something else? Does correlation between two variables imply causation? Who thinks that correlation between two variables implies causation? No one. So what else do we need? Well, we need to consider the rival explanations. And the reason why we measure growth motivation before growth is to do the reduction of influence. And then we have two strategies for eliminating rival explanations. We could do an experiment, but it's not really feasible to manipulate the growth willingness of actual companies. I have no idea how to do it. So instead, we go for the second strategy. So we do control variables. And the idea of control variables is that they are alternate explanations for the data. So let's say that growth motivation and growth are correlated. We have to ask why. Could it be that there is actually no causal relationships, but for example, young companies are very growth motivated. So you have a person who comes straight from the school and founds a startup. Those guys really want to grow the company. And the company is also very small because it's newly founded. That creates a correlation. Whereas in a company that has existed for 10 years, then probably there's not much growth motivation anymore. It's just you're doing it for a living. So the enthusiasm from the beginning has decreased. Or it could be a size effect. It could be that smaller companies, not younger companies, are more growth motivated because they must grow. If your company makes 30,000 euros per year of revenue. It's too small. It can't survive. It has to do more. And because it's a small company, it's easier to grow, because usually growth is measured as relative change. So we say that a company grew by 5%, and it's a lot easier to add 5% to a little amount than adding 5% to a large amount. For example, it's not unheard of that companies double their size small companies double or triple their sales in 1 year. But think about large software companies, like what it would take if Microsoft would double their sales in a year. That just doesn't happen. So for small companies, it's easier to grow. So we have to consider these alternate explanations. And we do that by using control variables. So we need to at least control for company age and company size when we study this. There are, of course, others, but for simplicity, those are the two things that we'll control for. Then we need to collect data. So we need to have a way of getting data for growth motivation, growth, company age, and company size. And that's our hypothesis. So which research design do we apply? Do we apply an experiment? No, we can't really manipulate the growth motivation of different companies. So we have to do an observational study. So the observational studies were survey, field research, and archival records. How do we measure growth motivation? Any suggestions? Somebody else. How do we measure growth motivation? If you want to know how much a company wants to grow, what do you do? Yes. So the more typical option is to do a survey. So you ask the manager of the company, do you want to grow or not? Or how much do you want to grow? You could do a secondary data analysis, the archival records, but in this case I'm looking at small companies, and those companies don't really produce that much documentation that we could analyze. So how do we measure growth? Well, we first have to define what growth is. So does growth mean adding people or selling more, or what does it mean? And we have to define whether we mean that whether we are looking at absolute growth in terms of people or euros, or relative growth in terms of percentages. Relative growth makes a lot more sense in this case, and the typical way we measure growth of companies is not the employment, but it's how much money the company makes. So what's the total sales of the company? So how do we get total sales of companies? We collect total sales at time two and time three, and then time one and time two, and then we divide time two by time three, and that gives us growth. So how do we get the data? Do we do a survey, a field study, or an archival record study? We need to get the revenues of the companies, how much they sell. Yeah, we could get, because that's public data in Finland. We could also do a survey, but survey is a pretty bad idea because this is data that the government collects. So we don't want to bother the owners of these companies because the data exists already. So we call the government, the Statistics Finland, we ask where to get this data, and they will tell us that these and these companies sell you the data set. You can also get the data set from online for free. So we have a combination of a survey and our archival data. We apply a survey to measure this company's growth motivation, and then we do secondary data analysis. So that's what I did. I've been running this survey of Finnish software companies, first in Aalto and now here, for a couple of years, with Eetu Luoma, and then we used this data. That's real data that we collected. It's our survey form here. It's also, you can answer it online. And then we have data from a database. So there are these web-based databases that allow you to extract data for companies. And then the next question is, we collect data, we do a survey, so how much? How many companies do we need? And it depends on many things, but a good rule of thumb to start with is that if you have less than 100 observations, then that's perhaps too little for a statistical analysis. That's not the strict limit, so you can do with less, but usually less than 100, then people will start asking questions. If you have more than 200 observations, then in most cases, nobody is going to ask questions. So between 100 and 200 is a good sweet spot for data collection. We don't collect 10,000 data points because when we do a survey, each contact that we do with the companies has a small cost associated with it. So we need to buy some of this data, or we need to send out survey forms. And also, if we can make do with our 200 observations, then if we collect 2,000, it means that we have used the time of owners of companies, of 1,800 companies that we don't really need. So we don't want to go overboard. And sometimes people look at response rates. So if we send out 1,000 invitations, how many of those invitations actually replied? So if we send out 1,000 invitations to a survey, 100 companies respond, then we have a 10% response rate. The response rate, while people look at it a lot, it's actually not very important. The more important thing is that you have enough data, so the number of observations is enough, and that the sample is representative of the population that you study. So because survey is such a common data analysis technique, we'll go quickly through what the survey involves. So when you do a survey, there are three main things. You have to design the survey form. So you have to come up with the questions, and then if you do a paper-based survey, you have to put those questions on a paper that gets printed, or if you do an online survey, you need to enter the questions in an online system. There are some design issues that you need to take into account when you do that. Then you need to decide who is the sample, so who is going to be invited to participate in your survey. In master's theses, quite often you study fellow students, so or you study your friends. If you study how people react to people use technology, then people you sample from your Facebook friends and things like that. That's one way of doing it. Then we have administering the survey, so that's all the procedures. If you send invitations to companies, then the companies will tell you that we don't want to respond to this survey. Then you have to record that so that you will not ask them to respond again. Also, when you do a survey, quite often it's a good idea to send a reminder. So when you send an invitation to survey, then people will see, okay, this is a survey, and then they'll forget about it. Then 2 weeks later, you send a reminder for those who haven't responded yet and those who haven't told you that they don't want to participate. Then they will see, okay, this is the survey that I got invited to 2 weeks ago, and then they're more likely to respond. When I do survey studies, typically about one-third of my respondents come from the first invitation, and two-thirds come after the reminder. So if you send two reminders, then your response rate is going to be probably about three times as much as if you just send them one invitation. Also, if you give people 1 month time to respond, you will get a lot more responses than if you say that please respond by this Wednesday. Normally, you're not in a hurry. Then comes the data analysis, their data cleaning, which is the first task. Some people give you garbage answers. Then all kinds of other analysis that you could consider. The key parts in doing a survey is that you should plan well before, because when you send out your survey questionnaire, if you at that point realize that you have forgotten a question from the survey, that's very difficult to fix. Also, if your invitation is written in a confusing way, then it's very that decreases the response rate, and it's very difficult to fix later on. Then allow enough time to respond. Don't rush people. So people are volunteering to answer your survey, so don't rush them. And then make responding easy, and then provide incentives to respond. For example, when you ask companies to answer your survey, tell them that if you answer this survey, I will send you the results of my study. And that could be interesting for some people, and they will see that, okay, I get something back from that. And finally, one thing that makes it incentivizes people to respond is that the survey is not too long. So if you're asking people to give 15 minutes of their time, that's a lot more than asking them to give 5 minutes. So if you need 5 minutes, then you'll get lots more responses. If you say that this survey will take half an hour of your time, you ask people in companies to respond, they can't do it during the coffee break, they will not do it. So 15 minutes is about the maximum. If you can do with less, that's better. Then we need to decide, how do we measure growth willingness? That was the most important thing that we measure in a survey for this particular example. And I'm measuring growth willingness using these questions here. These questions measure three different things. So I'm asking first about the general growth motivation of the company. So one of the questions is that the growth of the company is one of the most important objectives of our managers. So do the managers really value that? And also one is that the company doesn't need to grow. So that's a negative indicator of growth willingness. Then I also ask about risk-taking, because you really can't grow if you don't take any risks. So that's an important part of the concept of growth motivation. If you say that, yes, we want to grow a lot, but you're not willing to take any risks for it, then you're not really that growth motivated. And then when we look at the software industry in Finland, growing almost always means that at some point you have to expand internationally because the Finnish software markets are so small. Of course, you could be a born global company that targets the global markets, for example, App Store right away or internet-based sales. But in more traditional business, you sell, you need to do sales work for each one of your customers. So you first sell in Finland, and then you start to sell in Netherlands, UK, and Sweden. And then you expand to USA. That's a more common approach. So we need to ask about those three dimensions. And this, when I was thinking about what does it mean to grow or be more growth-oriented in this particular population, the small software companies in Finland, this is the process of conceptualization. So what does it conceptually mean that you're growth motivated? Then I started thinking what could be a good indicators. We develop these questions ourselves. It's usually a better idea, particularly if you're a master's thesis, if you can get the questions that somebody else has used. They are typically reported in a research paper, like Venkates reports his questions. Then you take those.
In some questionnaires, I see the categories mixed in together. Is there any point to doing that?
Yes. So this is we ask them in order because this is a printed survey. In an online survey, it's a good idea to randomize the questions. That eliminates the risk that how you answer the previous question influences the next question. So that if you mix the questions, that eliminates the risk of what we call common method variance. It's very common to do it that way, like we did, but it's actually better if you randomize the order. So then the order of the question doesn't influence how people respond if you vary from person to person. So always randomize if you do an online system. But this is paper-based. Then we have the workflow. So we have done our survey. So what do? We have now survey data. These, let's say, 400 responses from companies in small software companies in Finland using the survey form I just showed you. And then we have data sets from a public database that gives the age and size of these companies. So the construct in the database typically means that you usually have multiple files. So this is the Excel files. We have the data file .csv, so survey data in the back, and then we have three sets of files from a database, because the database only allows us to export, let's say, 200 companies at a time. And if we have 500 responses, then we need to extract three batches of 200 to be able to reach 500. So we need to combine four files into one file. So how do we go about this? Because as you saw in the SPSS screenshot, you need to have one data file that you then analyze. So there are a couple of strategies. One fairly common strategy is to use Excel. So this is an actual master's thesis that I've seen, and there's this Excel formula that is 7 lines long, and that then merges different data sets. If you know how to do that, then that's a good idea. But the problem with that strategy is that it's very difficult to point in find problems from that. So if there is an error in that formula, it can take forever for you to figure out why it doesn't work. Another strategy that you can apply is to use your statistical software. I've done this data analysis exercise with Stata and R, and also SPSS, but only with a point and click. So you can tell the write a command file for your statistical analysis software. Tell the statistical analysis software the first we append first the three data files one after another from the database. So that creates us one data file that contains the data from three data files, and then we merge it with the survey data file. So these data analysis files that you apply in statistical software basically explain the procedure that you apply for getting these four data sets, three from the database, one from the survey, together, so you have one data that you can actually analyze. So which techniques should you apply? If you just do your master's thesis and you don't want to do any research, go for Excel. You don't need to learn any of this stuff. If you want to do this for a living and do a PhD, then definitely don't use Excel for that. So most professionals don't use Excel for data management. Then the next thing is to explore your data set. One of the key ingredients to useful data analysis is that you understand your data before you start analyzing it. And understanding the data refers to doing all kinds of stuff. And I can provide you, I have these with Stata and R as the analysis files. I provide those to the website, and these refer to the line numbers in my example code. I forgot to upload that. So what we do is we do histograms, we calculate means, standard deviations, correlations. We calculate all kinds of statistics that allow us to understand the data. So if we survey companies, some of the things that we want to know before we start analyzing data is what kind of companies are these? Are they small companies? What's the average revenue for company? What's the median? So median in this case tells a lot more than the average, because let's say that Tieto, for example, answers our survey, and then they get included in our sample. They have hundreds of millions of revenue, and then most of the companies are in the ballpark of hundreds of thousands or a few million. If we add one company that makes hundreds of millions of revenue, that really increases the mean. So median is probably the better statistic here. Then we want to understand, are there any extreme values like Tieto? And that kind of things. So understanding your data, are there some companies that say that their revenues are zero, or that the revenues are, let's say, 10,000 euros per year? Because those are not viable businesses. Or it could be somebody's side job. Say they have a business that they work for one day per week, something like that. Do you have any idea how much money a company has to make in order to be sustainable? So how much money does a company have to make to be able to employ one person? How much money per year? Any idea? No one of you has ever considered being an entrepreneur. 100,000 euros is a pretty good minimum. So if you make 100,000 euros, then after all the expenses, you will probably get 30,000, 40,000 euros yourself. And whether that's a good salary for your investment of being an entrepreneur, that's up to you to decide. So we can see here, this is the revenues, that some of the companies are very small. So 25% of the companies actually have less than 100,000 euros per year of revenue. So some of these companies are really just starting. So maybe studying their growth doesn't really make that much sense. So that kind of things. Then another very useful thing is to look at the data graphically. So that's a scatterplot matrix of the full data. The idea of a scatterplot is that you have x-axis and y-axis that represent two variables, and then each point represents one observation on those two variables. And this allows us to check for patterns, correlations in the data. So I'll just look at the first variables here. So we have growth motivation items here. We can see that they are a growth motivation item. One and three are correlated. Second is negatively correlated because the second question was we don't need to grow anymore. So we can identify these patterns graphically. then that gives us an idea. Why they're clustered like that is because these are 1 to 5 scales, so it's a dichotomous variable or discrete variable. Then we can see growth here, and there are a couple of extremely small values, some extremely large values here, and that's 1 year growth. So we do this kind of graphical summaries to understand the data, understand if there are some observations that are different from others, and understanding overall what our sample is like. So these are small startups. These are companies. The next step is creating composite measures. So the idea of a composite measure is that when you have multiple measures that are supposed to measure the same thing, then we take a sum of those measures or mean to come up with a single number that quantifies the attribute that we are very interested in. So for example here, in this scale, we have 3 questions that measure general growth attitude. And to come up with a variable that we can apply in a regression analysis, we just need 1 variable. So we take an average of those items, and that average is more reliable than any of the individual variables, typically. At this point, we also also evaluate the validity and reliability of our measures. So validity was basically whether the measure measures what it is supposed to measure. The idea being that if there is variation in how companies want to grow, then that variation should cause variation in our data. But there's also some measurement error in our data. So the 1 to 5 scale, whether you want to grow or not, is not a perfect measure of companies' growth willingness. So we can't say that when 2 companies have answer 3 on whether you want to grow or not on a 1 to 5 point scale, those companies are exactly the same growth willingness. No, because there could be some measurement error there. So maybe one company say that we are really 3.2, but that's not an option, so let's answer 3. And one company thinks that we are really 2.8, but that's not an option, so let's answer 3. So that causes measurement error in our data. In practice, we do the validity and reliability assessment in 2 steps. The first step is a factor analysis. So we start by asking the computer that these 8 questions that are in my growth motivation scale, please find underlying dimensions from the data. So what do these indicators have in common? That's what factor analysis tells us. If the factor analysis tells that the questions that are supposed to measure growth motivation, generally, have something in common, and the questions that are supposed to measure, let's say, international growth motivation have something in common, then we conclude that maybe that something in common is that the general growth motivation items measure one thing, which is general growth motivation, and the international growth motivation items measure another thing, which is international growth motivation. I'm going to apply exploratory factor analysis because it's a lot easier to apply, and that's what I recommend for you to do in your master's thesis. I did 2 rounds of factor analysis. I identified first that the questions about risk didn't really work. So I took those out. I decided that I will not be using those. And then I tell the computer that let's do a factor analysis of these items, general 1, 2, and 3, internationalization 1, 2, and 3. And the computer tells that these general items belong together. These international items belong together. And that's the result of what we want to see. That allows us to claim that maybe they belong together because they measure the same thing. This is also, we have oblique rotation here using the PROMAX algorithm because that's what my software does. So it's important that you do factor rotation. You don't have to understand what it means. You just have to understand that you have to do it. And factor rotation should be done with oblimin normally. I use PROMAX, which is pretty close to oblimin. Then once you have done this kind of analysis, then you write that in your report that you did a factor analysis, and the factor analysis supported that the indicators measure what they are supposed to measure. Of course, it's only indirect evidence, because it just tells that these indicators may measure the same thing. It doesn't tell us what the thing is that they measure. The second thing that we need to consider in the analysis is reliability. Reliability is typically assessed with something called Cronbach's alpha, and you don't, again, have to understand fully what it does, but it's just something that your statistical software will calculate for you. So the idea in reliability assessment is that if we have items that measure the same thing, then taking a sum of those items is more reliable than any item individually. Then we apply Cronbach's alpha, we will get the result. We take the general items here, and Cronbach's alpha is 0.88. Typically, 0.7 is considered something that is just acceptable. If you have less than that, then people are going to start asking questions. If you have more than that, then people are going to be fine with it. So reliability and validity typically reported that way. So you just say that it's above certain threshold. It's simple to do, but this is, of course, there are some nuances to that you have to then learn if you want to do postgraduate studies. All right, so we do, in the measurement validation part, using our survey data, we do three things. We do a factor analysis, which tells which indicators go together. If the indicators go together as expected, then that's considered as evidence of validity. Then if we have measures that go together based on factor analysis, we can calculate the reliability of that scale by applying Cronbach's alpha. Then we take a sum of those indicators that go together and then apply that in our further analysis as a composite measure. So that's the three tasks that we do in the measurement validation part of the analysis. Okay, then comes descriptive statistics. So before you do any regression analysis or any main analysis, it's important thing that you calculate the correlation matrix, means and standard deviations of the final variables that will go to regression analysis, because that provides you and your readers some information about the data that can be useful. So this is the descriptive statistics for the Venkatesh paper. They have two samples. They have government website sample and online appointment booking service sample. So these are the means and standard deviations and the reliability statistics for those variables. And then we have correlation. So the correlation table is not symmetric, because the upper triangle is, or this part, is for one of the samples, and this is the correlations for the other sample. So they had two studies in the same paper, or they replicated the same study with two samples. Then you go through those correlations, and then you ask yourself, do these correlations make sense? Are all large correlations reasonable? So is there a good reason that there's a correlation? And are there any variables that we should expect to be correlated but that are not? So that's our correlation. So I created two variables measuring growth. I had growth over 1 year and growth over 3 years. 3 year growth is a more stable, it measures more like a longer term stable growth, because 1 year growth can be unstable. It's just if you happen to get a deal right after the change of the year, then that kind of chance occurrences influence the growth measures quite a lot for the 1 year data. So we have growth, we have age of the company, which we use as a control variable, and then we have our revenue of the company. I'm taking logarithms for reasons that I'll explain in a minute. Then we have profits and growth motivation. We are not really interested in profits that much here, but that's included in the analysis. Then we take a look at, okay, so what are the largest correlations here? We can see that our revenue and profits are highly correlated, 0.66. Does it make sense? Yeah, the more the company sells, the more profits it makes. It makes a lot of sense. If a company doesn't sell anything, they can't make any profits. It also both measure company size. So Nokia sells a lot, their profits are a lot more than, a student-founded startup that employs two people. So that's both measure company size. They are company growth for over 1 year correlates negatively with company age here. Does it make sense that growth correlates negatively with size, with age? Well, think about it. If you're a company that is has just been started, the only thing that it can do is grow. And your initial revenues are very small, so adding a little to a very small amount, it's a large relative growth. If you have an older company, it's likely to be larger, and then if it's larger, then it's more difficult to grow. So if it's a lot easier to add 10% to 1,000 euros than adding 10% to 1 million euros. Same thing, we can see that company revenue is slightly negatively correlated with growth for the same reason. That's a surprisingly small negative correlation. So we ask, do these correlations make sense? We go through every correlation. We ask ourselves, is this expected? If there's an unexpected correlation or a correlation that we would have expected but wasn't there, then we write about that in our report. Once we have done the correlation analysis, then we go to the main analysis. And my steps, rules of thumb for the main analysis is that you always start with regression analysis. Regression analysis may not be the ideal technique that you'll apply in the end, but it's a simple technique to start with, and it'll always tell you something that you haven't discovered from the correlations only. So the workflow is that you do at least two regression models. So you do the model with control variables only, and then you do the model with the controls and the interesting variables, and then you check whether the second model explains the data better than the first model by comparing the R-square statistic. If the second model explains the data better than the first model, then you conclude that the interesting variables that you added in the second model actually make a difference. Then, after a regression analysis, you do diagnostics, you identify any potential issues in the analysis, you fix the issues, and then you proceed. So the idea of regression analysis was that it allows us to assess which of multiple variables really matter. So we had a CEO gender example and profitability example, and let's say that the CEO gender variance is here, performance variation is here, and they overlap, so that means that CEO gender and performance of a company correlate. Regression analysis asks the question of how much of this correlation can be explained by a third variable. So how much of the gender performance overlap can be explained by company size, for example. Or the other way, how much the company size performance overlap can be explained by gender. So it identifies the unique effect of one variable when controlling for others. So regression analysis basically takes these bytes away from the data and then asks, how much of the effect remains after we eliminate the influence of a third variable. These third variables are the controls based on our theory. In this case, we control for company size and company age. Then regression analysis fits a line through your data. So if in a two-variable case, it's easy to visualize that you have a scatter plot of your data, and then you have a line that goes through the data, computer finds a line, and then we expect all the observations to be equally spread over the line. And it makes some assumptions. I'll show you those in a few slides. So we do a regression analysis, and then let's do regression of one-year growth and controls. Then your statistical software will give you a printout. What's the important thing to understand about this printout is that you don't have to understand every single number. And even if you understand every single number, what they mean, you don't typically have to interpret those. But there are, in the regression analysis and any statistical analysis, there are usually two kinds of numbers. We have indices that explain how good is the model overall, and then we have coefficients here that explain what are the regression results, so how much of each individual variable matters. So coefficients are about the variables that go into the analysis, indices are about the overall goodness of the model. So this is a lot of numerical information. So instead of interpreting the results from this table, I will do four regression models, show them in one table. So these software allow you to group models. So I have four models. This is the similar kind of table that you see in the Venkatesh article. So we have each column in the table is one regression model. Then, like in the Venkatesh's models, we have the coefficients here, up here, and then these are the indices down here. And the important parts that we will interpret from here are first the R-square statistic. So does the model explain the data at all? And is the model, the model with the interesting variables and the controls, is it a better model than the model with just the controls? So the first model, M1, is the controls-only model. We can see that it explains 3.6% of the variation of the dependent variable. It's not much, but it's something. And then when we add the interesting variable, the growth motivation here, then we are up to 4.7% explanation. So we explain roughly 5% of the differences in variation in growth rate with this model. Then the second two are for the three-year growth. So for the three-year growth, we explain 5.1%. Based on this analysis, I conclude that my model is better at explaining three-year growth than one-year growth. Then we need to ask the question before we interpret the regression coefficients themselves. Are these models any good? So are there any problems with the models? And to do that, we need to do diagnostics for the analysis. So regression analysis makes assumptions, and some of the assumptions are, or these are the assumptions, it's a linear model, so we say that all relationships between these variables are linear. If they're like a U-shape, so that one effect first increases and then decreases, or exponential, then regression analysis is not the right tool. We have to do something else. And we do this by inspecting the residuals. Understanding the residual is perhaps easier when we look at the concept of outlier. So the idea of regression analysis was that it draws a line to the data, but sometimes we have one observation or few observations that are very far from the others. So this black dot here is an outlier. It's very different from others. It could be that it's genuinely a case that is very different. That's, for example, if you look at software companies in Finland that are less than 10 years old, Supercell is a genuine outlier. So they are like 100 times bigger than the next biggest company in terms of sales. Whether we want to include a Supercell in our analysis or not, that's debatable. I will probably exclude it because it's so unique case that when we want to explain what a typical company does, how the relation between growth motivation and growth works for a typical company, then Supercell is not typical. We should probably throw it out. Another thing that these outliers could be that maybe it's a data entry mistake. If you ask a company to report how much revenues they make, and the CEO says that they make 1 million, but accidentally only types 5 zeros instead of 6, then the revenue is 1/10 of what it's supposed to be. So that could create an outlier observation. So how do we do these diagnostics? How do we find out whether we have outliers or any other problems? Is that we take the residuals from the model. So the residual was the difference between the regression line that contains the values for these cases predicted by the model, and then we analyze the residuals. So this is the next plot is one of the first diagnostics plots that I do after regression analysis. So here each dot presents an observation in the data, and we have the residual here, so how far from each observations are from the regression line, and then what is the corresponding value on the regression line, the fitted value. So if the regression line predicts a certain growth for each company, so these are the predicted values. So the residual was the difference between the predicted value by the regression model and the value that we actually observe. We can see that we have two cases that are far from others, so those are potential outliers. We could study those companies if they're really different from others, or if there are data entry mistakes, or why there. Usually there's a good reason why one observation is very different from others. We can also see that the residuals kind of like open up to the right. So on the left-hand side, the residuals are very close to the regression line. On the right-hand side, they open up. And also, all the high residuals are positive. When we see that kind of pattern in the data, when we have lots of positive outliers, but no negative outliers, so no companies is shrinking a lot faster than others, then it's a good idea to inspect what does the distribution of the variable look like. So we do a histogram of the three-year growth now. We can see that most companies are here on the left-hand side. So this is the histogram. Most companies grow only a little. And then we have these few bins that we can't really see that represent one or two companies each that grow a lot more than other variables. When we see that kind of pattern in the data, then it's a good place to apply logarithm to the data. So logarithm changes the focus to relative differences instead of absolute differences. So when we take a logarithm of the three-year growth, we will get that kind of histogram from the data. So this is a lot more useful kind of data for our analysis. Because here, most observations are here, and then we have a few that are far from the one bar. So this histogram gives us a lot more to work with than this histogram here. So when you see that kind of data sets, applying a logarithm can make the data more analyzable. Okay, we take a logarithm of the revenues, and let's focus on the three-year growth. Previously, we were able to explain 5.1% of the growth using the final model. And after taking a logarithm of the growth, we explain 7.1%. So the model is about 50% better in explaining a dependent variable. That's a good thing. So we identified a problem. The problem was that the observations were a lot more spread out and kind of like bending up in the high growth company. When we take a logarithm, then that eliminates that problem, and we can get more explanation out of the data. The next thing that we do is another round of diagnostics. One thing that I like to check is the distribution of the residuals. So this is a density diagram. It's basically the same thing as a histogram, but instead of being bins where you divide data, this is more like a continuous measure of how the variable is distributed. We can still see that we have some observations with a high residual. So they grow a lot more than what the model would predict. So that's maybe something that we want to do something about. Quite often, it's desirable for the residuals to be about normally distributed, or at least symmetric. But now we have the left-hand side, we don't have any large negative residuals. We have some large positive residuals. We can also do outlier analysis. And outlier analysis, we have a squared residual here, and we have leverage here, which is another way of quantifying how important observations are. We can see that we have a couple of observations that are far from others. We should study what those are. And then finally, Most always do these plots where I plot the residual against different explanatory variables. In these diagnostic plots, the idea is that the observation should be a band around the regression line. So when we are looking at the left-hand side of the regression line here, this person of these estimates, these observations should be equal to this one here. And we can see here that in the low profit companies, these are close to the regression line. High profit companies, they're far from regression line. Small revenue companies, far from regression line. High revenue companies, close to regression line. So we have these observations that are far from the regression line. That's a potential problem, because we normally want all the observations to be close to the line and about equally far, regardless of which part of the line we look at. So these are companies that don't do much revenue. The next thing that we need to now take a look at is to understand the revenue variables. So what does they are? If we have a problem with small revenue variable companies, then how small is small? So how much is small? So let's take a summary of the revenue variable. And the summary gives us a mean and standard deviation. So mean is 3 million. Standard deviation is quite high. We don't really interpret it that much, but it's about 20 million, I think. Or 3 million, either way. Then we look at the median. So median tells what is if we put the observations on a line, so what's the ordered by revenue, so what's the value in the middle? That's 300,000. And then we have these companies, 25% of the companies, that are less than 93,000 euros. So what do we do? When we think about all the software companies in Finland, so that's what kind of companies that include? It includes Tieto, it includes F-Secure, it includes some local company that has five developers and a CEO, and it also includes people who code something for the App Store and sell it as a hobby to finance their studies, for example. So not all companies are actually viable full-time businesses. So what do we do? If we want to explain how much growth motivation of a company influences growth, then we probably don't want to focus on those companies that are just hobbies or that are side jobs. Like I've had a software company, I developed something that I used for my work, and I realized that maybe somebody else could use this as well. I put it to App Store, I made a few thousand euros per year. But that's not a business organization. So maybe we should remove firms with less than 100,000 of revenue, because those are not viable full-time businesses. So let's focus only on those 75% of the cases or a bit more that have more than 100,000 euros of revenue. Because for small companies, the dynamics is probably very different from these real business organizations. So we go again, and for the three-year growth, we are now close to 8% explanation. So we started with 5, we went to less than 5, we went to 7.1, and now we're close to 8%. And then we do diagnostics again, we do the residuals, we can see that there are still some companies that grow more than what the model predicts, but we don't have these extreme companies anymore. So the model is now better for the data when we focus only on a subset of the data. And this is pretty close to being normally distributed, and that's something that we can live with. So the idea of these diagnostics is that we do them after each analysis. We can see here now that while we still have some more dispersion here than here, it's not as severe as before. So this is called heteroscedasticity problem, and we could still do some things about it, but it's beyond this course, what do we do? The idea is that every time you apply statistical analysis, then you look at, okay, so my statistical analysis tries to explain one variable. How well does it do it overall? That's what the R-square tells us. And then which observations it predicts well and which ones it doesn't, that's the next question. That's what these diagnostics do for you. If you use SPSS and you click all the options, then you will get all these plots that I demonstrated to you. In Stata, these are part of the normal regression flow workflow in R as well. Okay, so we are happy with the result now. And then what we do is we move to the part of supporting analysis. We can do a a couple of things. We can do a selection effect. So would it be possible that the analysis holds, the result holds for some companies but not others? So we could, for example, look at those companies that are less than 5 years old, do a regression analysis on that. Are the results same as they are for the full analysis? If they are different, then we try to explain why. We could look at those companies that are, let's say, run by a man CEO, for example, compared to women CEO, and see if the results are different. Then we tell what these additional analyses tell us. Selection effect is something that that we can assess by comparing if those companies that actually responded to our survey questionnaire are different from those that didn't. So is there some kind of, let's say, that the companies that grow faster, are they more likely to respond to our analysis, to our survey, than an average company? We can do that because we get the company revenues from a database, and we can also get the revenues for those companies that we send an invitation to that eventually didn't respond. Once you have done this, so you have done the main analysis, you have done the diagnostics for the main analysis, and you're happy with your model, then you do an analysis using subsamples, then you're done. Then you just write the paper. You do the tables, and the regression table that we had a few slides from now, you format that in Word, and then you write what you did and how you integrate, and then that's your result. Then you go and do the conclusions and what the results mean. So once you have the regression table done and the correlation table, then you are about 70 or 80% of the way of being having finalized your study, even if you haven't really written anything about it. Because it's very easy to just go back and then write your results, your method section. Just tell your readers what you did. There is no creativity involved. A few final words about quantitative research. So this is just going to be a few minutes, so we'll still go for 5 more minutes. The first question is, should I do a quantitative study and why? There are good and bad reasons to do a quantitative study. One is good reason to do a quantitative study, the reason why I do quantitative studies instead of qualitative studies, that I like doing this kind of research a lot more than I like analyzing interview transcripts that Arthur will talk to you about. But beyond that, quantitative analysis has a certain place and qualitative analysis has a certain place. Quantitative analysis is typically applied for scenarios where we already know something. So we have a good enough understanding of the phenomenon that we can make hypotheses. So we understand that, or we have a good idea that if the owner of a company wants the company to grow, that probably influences whether the company grows or not. If your owner says, I don't want this company to grow, and it tells that all employees, most likely the company will not grow. So we have a good understanding of this phenomena. Then the quantitative analysis tells us how much, so how strong is the effect. We have an idea that growth motivation could have an effect. How large is the effect? So this is good for testing theories and refining theories. Under which conditions do things matter? Qualitative research, on the other hand, is good for like greenfield scenarios. So if we have no idea why certain companies grow more than others, then if you have no idea, then how could we possibly know that we should measure companies' growth motivation? Then we go and we interview those companies, or we go and we work with those companies, we write down our observations, and then we try to infer what caused some companies to grow, whereas others didn't. So qualitative analysis and qualitative studies are typically focused on early stages of research, when we have a green field, and then quantitative is for more mature fields. Then we have, once you have decided, okay, quantitative analysis or quantitative studies, the kind of study that you want to do, we have three things about research design that we have to, after we have a research question. Then what units do I observe? If we study growth motivation of companies and that effect on growth, which companies? And what do I need to measure? And then what are the relationships of interest, including if you have a correlation of two variables, what are the biggest plausible alternative explanations for that variable. Quite often, small company, small organization, that could cause a systematic difference. Smaller companies are more likely to be growth willing, smaller companies are grow also more, causes a correlation. Smaller companies are more likely to have women CEOs than larger companies, smaller companies are more profitable than larger companies, that causes a correlation. So we need to think through these alternate explanations. After you decide these, then you collect the data and you do an analysis. We had four main designs for collecting data. We had an experiment. Important thing in experiment is that we randomize. So we randomize, half of our sample goes to treatment, half goes to control. We do something for the treatment, we don't do it for the control, we look at the outcome. Then we had our survey, which is the most common. We go out, we ask people questions. People give us data about their companies, people give us data about themselves by answering surveys. Field research is observation of others, and then archival data is data collected by somebody else. You have data, and then the question is, which analysis you apply? Quite often, you start with a regression analysis. Then there may be good reasons to use something else. And I recommend that you take a good book. And or, for example, Ketokivi's book is pretty great in Finnish. So he explains what kind of analysis techniques there are. And there are also English books that do the same. Or you can just pick your statistical analysis manual. So Status User Manual, for example, has a section of about 30 pages that explains the different categories of things that you can do and which analysis is the best for which kind of thing, according to the developer's opinion. Then think about the theoretical process instead of the data. So if your data are number of years from 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, then the number is, it's 5 distinct numbers. But the phenomena that you're studying is time, so it's actually continuous. So you have to do an analysis that supports continuous variables, like a regression analysis. Then always choose the simplest possible thing that you can apply and see what it does. Then you check for the do diagnostics. If the diagnostics don't show you any problems, then by all means, use the simple technique. Regression analysis is almost always not a bad choice. Then we have also others, like regression analysis can be extended to variables that are ones and zeros. That's we call it logistic regression. Or we have a category like Finland, Sweden, Norway, that would be multinomial regression. Or if we have a variable that is a count, then we would use a Poisson regression one. So these are just there are different options that extend regression analysis to various directions. But it's always a good idea to start with regression analysis. And then if you are working on a master's thesis, then your supervisor will tell you that, well, regression analysis is not the right tool for this thing. Apply one of these alternatives. The step from regression analysis to one of these alternatives is actually pretty easy step. You just switch the analysis command, and they are specified the same. So every model, all statistics are done the same way. You interpret the model by looking at, well, what are the regression coefficients, which ones are significant, which ones are large, which ones are small, what's the direction. Then does the model explain the data at all? That's the R-square statistic. Then we can do model comparisons. Regression models are compared using the R-square statistic. Is the R-square for one model larger than for another model? Then we do diagnostics, and that's for every model as well. And then we interpret the results. So we do the two tables, and then we write the paper around the two tables. Finally, you end up your study by summarizing what you have learned about reliability and validity in your measurement section, what you have learned about, then you assess statistical conclusion validity. Do you think that you apply the tools correctly, basically? Internal validity. Do you think that there could be some omitted control variables? And external validity is basically, given that your sample is, let's say, bakeries from Eastern Finland, to which conditions do you think that you can generalize from that sample? So that's what you do at the end of the study. And that's it about quantitative research. Don't need to clap, but if you have questions, you can ask them. And if you don't have questions, you can just leave and go for the next lecture. And this will be your Monivia stint.